Oh. Can you press stop?
COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal's only queer culture show that bridges any divide between queer sex and radical queer politics. Due to the fabulous nature of queer experience, tonight's program may contain sexually explicit or coarse language. You've been advised.
Welcome to Gender Reveal, a podcast where we hopefully get a little bit closer to understanding what the hell gender is. I'm your host and resident gender detective, Tuck Woodstock. Hey everyone, I hope you're all still hanging in there. Welcome to 2021, baby, we did it. Even if this year is just as bad as last year somehow, you survived 2020, and nobody can take that away from you, so good job. This week on the show, one of my very favorite interviews of the season, and that is saying a lot. Author Kai Cheng Tom is here to talk about, well, obviously her books.
I wish I could rewrite I Hope We Choose Love, actually, all the time.
But we also talk about Kai Cheng's secret life in the white goop lady world, why she stopped being a therapist, the history of the word femme, surviving in various leftist spaces.
What's going to happen when we are problematic? Well, we'd have to be gotten rid of. So then we develop, you know, a complex around, well, I can never be problematic.
It's such a good conversation and it is spicy.
This is a daring thing to say. So, you know, I take responsibility for if it's, wrong.
I do want to warn y'all that in the interview, we touch upon the concepts of assault and violence and suicidality. There are no details shared, but just a heads up, please take care of yourselves. But first, a different heads up. A heads up that our merch shop resets at the end of every month, as you probably know. So we've got 3 new designs in the site now, including one by Gender Reveal alum Maya Kobabe. In addition to the new designs, we've got a hoodie version of Beth's Trans Kids Are Wonderful, a beautiful fanny pack version of Ariana's Gender is a Boundless Expanse artwork. I promise I got the printing boundaries right this time. And we re-released Fern's Not Gay as in Happy, but Queer as in Fuck You t-shirt and stickers because we're still getting away with selling a thing that says fuck somehow. Maybe that's allowed. So check out the entire merch collection at bit.ly/gendermerch. And if you would like to submit a design to the shop, you can reach out with ideas at genderpodcast.com. And now it's time for This Week in Gender. Okay, this is the longest interview we've ever run, so I'm going to make This Week in Gender very short, lightning round, politics news edition. So here we go, 3 things. 1, in 2016, the Ohio Department of Health teamed up with the office of then-Governor John Kasich to ban trans Ohioans from updating the gender marker on their birth certificate. That is not news. The news is that last month, a federal judge struck down that policy, clearing the way for trans people in Ohio to fix the marker on their birth certificates and writing that, quote, the court finds that the defendant's proffered justifications are nothing more than thinly veiled post hoc rationales to deflect from the discriminatory impact of the policy. Hell yeah, judge. 2, thank you to Gender Reveal alum Jerry Che for sharing that back in September, the president of Argentina, Alberto Fernandez, signed a decree establishing a 1% employment quota for transgender people in the public sector. So for every 100 people that the government hires, one needs to be trans, my understanding. This is huge in general, but it is especially huge because according to LGBTQ activists in Argentina, nearly 100% of transgender folks there have never had formal employment. So this is literally their first time getting a paycheck. And finally, number three, Joe Biden added a trans woman, former U.S. Navy Commander Sean Skelly, to his presidential transition team. And I bring this up only to say that now that we're adding trans people to the transition team, it really makes me wonder why a single cis person has ever been allowed on something that's called the transition team. This has been This Week in Gender. Kai Cheng Tom is a writer, performer, community worker, somatic educator, lasagna lover, and Wicked Witch. She is the author of four award-winning books in various genres, including the novel Fierce Femmes and Notorious Liars, which was featured on Emma Watson's Feminist Book Club, and the essay collection I Hope We Choose Love. Kai Cheng has spoken and published widely on the topics of trauma and transformative justice. A lifelong student of healing and change work, Kai Cheng is currently pursuing deep study in mindfulness meditation, breathwork facilitation, and conflict resolution. So the way we always start the show is by asking, in terms of gender, how do you identify?
I identify as a woman, also as a trans woman, also as a non-binary trans woman.
Yeah, I see you often refer to yourself as a transsexual, and I would love to hear what appeals to you about the word transsexual specifically.
Oh, that's a really great question, and I super want to answer it because I think it's really juicy. I guess, you know, I'm a little protective of the word transsexual. I sort of like wrap my arms around it, and I'm like, nobody come for this word.
Mm-hmm, totally.
And I say that because I've heard some really virulent takedowns of the term transsexual, and I sort of get where they're coming from, but I still have that tenderness in me. Like, I love the word transsexual. It doesn't pop to mind as like the first thing when I'm meeting a new person. But let me see. Okay, so how do I come into being a transsexual? I certainly did not start out calling myself that when I first came out, which was when I was in my mid-teens as a kid in Vancouver, Canada. It was like the late 2000s, early 2010s. The word transgender was newly in vogue, like not trans quite yet, definitely not trans star. Non-binary was not quite a thing where I was. Like, it was beginning, but it wasn't as big as it is now as like an understood totally. Identity. And it was like still the time when cross-dresser and transvestite were considered démodé, but like still used by some people, you know, my age. So transsexual, I remember I was being trained to give these workshops in high schools about homophobia and queerness. And I would always say, what do we think transgender is? Transgender is an umbrella term, blah, blah, blah. And then I would say, what do we think transsexual is? Transsexual is a term that refers to people who have had a medical transition. It comes from the medical industrial complex, blah, blah, blah. And there was already even then this sort of shade of disdain, you know, like it comes from the medical complex. And then I don't remember quite who or like where, but there seemed to be these extra critiques layered onto that then, like, oh, and it's sexual, it foregrounds sex, but being trans is not about sexuality, it's about gender. So why are we making it all about sex? That's sort of, you know, voyeuristic. And then people were saying, and it's old, and, you know, it makes it so much about the body, and, you know, why aren't we thinking about, larger structures than the individual body? We should be doing, you know, big gender critiques. You know, I went to university by that time, so yeah. I was getting all these heavy things, and I was like, oh, okay, I guess. And so I sort of just absorbed this idea that transgender was me, especially because I hadn't had any medical transition at that time. And also because it was sort of like more fashionable and politically cool and stuff. And then I started medical transition. I went on hormones and became really like tied to the medical industrial complex in that way. When any of us who rely on a medication or a surgical procedure, we become tied to the medical industrial complex. And I felt shame. I also, you know, became, you know, more tied into like networks of women of color who identified as transsexual. And it became clear to me that many of the critiques of like transsexual as being sort of somehow sexually dirty and not intelligently revolutionary and too individualistic, that those terms were, yeah, part of my shame, part of it was just me. And then also largely these critiques, I had heard them from white, upper class, transmasculine people that I met at university, you know, at McGill University in Montreal. And so around that time, I started to hear trans women of color my age really beautifully reclaiming that term, transsexual. You know, there's an amazing, there's quite a few amazing videos where people are saying, like, I'm not transgender, I'm transsexual, fuck you, because it foregrounds the need for medical rights, you know, for determination over one's own body and the right to a sexuality, even as trans. And so, yeah, I was really into that for a while, but then I stopped doing medical transition. Like I went off hormones because I felt like I needed to. And I was like, huh, maybe I'm not a transsexual anymore. So I went through this whole thing. And I'm not quite sure where I land in terms of like, am I a transsexual or not these days? But I certainly think that we all have a right to the gender and sexuality identity terms that feel right for us. And I have such a tender spot for anyone who identifies as transsexual or for transsexuality. Like, I just think that's something that's deeply worthy. So yeah, that's how I feel about it.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing all that so much. You know, you have an advice column. It's called Advice for the Apocalypse. You have this book where the subtitle is A Trans Girl's Notes from the End of the World. Both of these were titled pre-pandemic. Then I keep trying to write a question and I'm just like, question mark, question mark, question mark. I think I just want to hear, like, you know, compared to the mindset that you were in, like when you were titling these things, like, how end of the worldy are you feeling? Does it feel the same? Does it feel different? Does it feel more or less apocalyptic, I think, is my question.
Oh, that's so funny, because I thought your question was going to be, did you see the future? Are you like prophetic or something? And that's really funny. Yeah, I mean, I love this question. I'm glad you noticed that, you know, my brand is apocalypse themed right now. You know, I've got so many answers to this. I feel like a really cool social justice answer would be the world was ending since before we were born, which it was.
Right. Right?
Like, there was very literally many people's worlds, indigenous people's worlds mostly, were ended by European colonization and by other kinds of imperialism as well. So that's a, you know, an important politically astute answer. I think another more personal to me kind of answer is my world started falling apart. Well, okay, I guess always, but my queer world really fell apart around 2015, 2016. And that was maybe particular to my cohort of anarchist Montreal queer friends. The thing you need to know about Montreal is that it's sort of like Berlin. The rent is cheaper than most places, like most major cities. So there's a lot of artists and like sex nerds and, you know, cool folks, a lot of queers and a lot of punks. And queerness and punkness and anarchism are so connected in Montreal in ways that they just aren't, like in New York or Toronto, where I am now. There is still like a heavy queer punk contingent, but in Montreal, like, you really cannot be queer without at least being a little punk, and you can't really be punk without being an anarchist. At least you couldn't at the time. And there were all of these horrible tragedies that happened in my group of like early 20-something queers, late teens queers, where people experienced assault at the hands of each other. And there were some attempts at addressing that, and they went really wrong, most of those attempts. So for me, I think it was the end of that world was like, I really had to grow up. But when I was forced to see that these ideas that I was really sort of strongly indoctrinated in, I don't say that in necessarily a negative way. Like, I believed them strongly, and I still kind of do, just a little less now, like about community being better equipped than the authorities to handle interpersonal violence. I had to really question that, because that was not the evidence in front of my eyes. And this is, I mean, I'm still a police abolitionist and a prison abolitionist in a very deep way, but I really lost my faith that normal people have a better way or better knowledge of how to deal with violence. We create so much more violence, right? Like police create violence, prisons create violence, and also to a lesser extent, but in a different way, you know, your normal everyday anarchist queer also creates violence. And yeah, that was a deep tragedy for me. My world ended then, and now it's the pandemic. There's all other kinds of worlds ending. Does it feel more apocalyptic to me now than it did in 2016? No, I guess. Because, you know, I was always ready for, like, economic devastation. I don't know why. I think maybe it's being, like, a child abuse survivor. But I always sort of thought, ah, yes, well, my family will die and the economy will collapse and my house will burn down. But it was this emotional devastation that really, really sunk in around 2015, 2016. Like, you know, of course you can't count on the bigger system. Of course you can't count on capitalism. But I guess a really naive part of me thought that I could count on my friends and my community in a particular way. And you know, I really learned that I couldn't in 2015, 2016. This is not to be nihilist. Like, I have lots of close friends and I believe in the power of friendship and, you know, My Little Pony and stuff. But there was an unfair, childish, I think a little naive expectation I had that you could take young or even older traumatized people and put them in a conditions of extreme stress, right? Extreme stress, extreme violence, and then expect that we would magically figure out how to replace the prison industrial complex all on our own by Tuesday. You know, like, that was naive. And so I don't feel like it's more apocalyptic now in that way, because that was always true. I just came to see it in that year.
Yeah. In your book, I Hope We Choose Love, that book takes its title from this essay on, like, love-based justice. And I know that justice is a huge part of the work that you do, the writing that you do. It seems like you've gone through different iterations of what justice has meant to you or looked like to you, as you were just referring to. Can you speak to what justice means to you now and how you think we can work towards justice in queer and trans communities, if that's a thing you think we should work towards?
I like to say a lot, and I said this all the time in the tour for I Hope We Choose Love. Like, I hope we choose love. I don't think we'll choose love. But also, you know, 2016 was the year I lost faith in community, but I didn't lose hope in community. And that's an interesting, you know, that does tie actually into my obsession, I guess, with yoga and meditation and wellness culture, which we might talk about later in this podcast, I suppose, because that's a non-dualism, right? Like, to lose faith but not hope, to hope but not believe. You know, how do we hold those two really contradictory things? Like, that sort of was the dilemma that broke my brain a little bit. What does that mean for justice? Well, I think we need to keep working toward a loving, healing, transformative justice. And I don't just say that as an affect. You know, I wish I could rewrite I Hope We Choose Love actually all the time, because I Hope We Choose Love was heavy on affect, like emotion and analysis, but it was not super big on, like, concrete structured solutions, which would have been a lot to ask of a 25-year-old, 24-year-old writer, you know, at the time. Now that I'm the ripe age of 29, you know.
Yes, as a fellow 29-year-old, we know everything.
Exactly. We're wise elders looking down, right? Oh, that's funny. And the sad thing is, of course, is most of us at 29, as 29-year-old transsexuals or transgenders, we haven't had trans older people, right? I don't have real trans elders, really, apart from maybe, well, I don't really know if I do, but it takes more than feeling like we want to replace the prison system and the police system, which we have lots of that now, like lots of feeling. But you might notice, and this is a daring thing to say, so, you know, I take responsibility for if it's, you know, wrong in any way. Like, you might notice, though, that a lot of the people in media and social media, perhaps also in real life, who are saying, you know, I want to abolish the police, in another moment of stress and feeling threatened, might say, throw those other people in prison, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, like, people saying, I'm an abolitionist, but abusers should get the death sentence, right? And that is not, to my thinking, an abolitionist framework. There are lots of, like, I believe in revenge fantasies. I like revenge fantasies. And I believe that we have the right to anger. But if we are to have a coherent, workable, politic that drives community action, we need to be able to separate our fantasy of revenge and our emotion of anger from a consistent ethic of abolitionism. Or we don't, and then, you know, we can make a clear choice about that. But, like, I'm just saying we need actual structures. Like, what is community mediation? We need to know the answer to that question. This is what I'm doing now, is, like, I'm doing a certificate in alternative dispute resolution. Like, what are the nuts and bolts of how, for example, mediation works, or a restorative justice circle? How do you actually do that? How does transformative justice work? And I really like this sort of nuts and bolts approach, because it, you know, you take a real case study, you take a real example from your life. I mean, I'm getting into conflict all the time, right? Like, I just had a few yesterday, but each one becomes its own little laboratory for, you know, what are the actual skill sets and frameworks that I can use to resolve them, hopefully in a more loving way. And if one looks into transformative justice, you'll see a lot of people in queer community saying transformative and restorative justice, as though that were a single phrase, right? And people sort of think that means, oh, you get together in a circle and you talk about all the bad things. And that's kind of true, but actually there's deep theory, deep scholarship, deep practice, many, 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 many nuances. And by that, I don't mean like thought nuances. I mean practice nuances. Like, when do you bring people together after a harm? What do you do first? What do you do after? What do you do if someone in an accountability process decides to call the police or decides to sue someone, right? Like, what are all the steps that you can do to make these things safer, more likely to succeed? How do you define success? Like, no one is going to be holding hands and singing Kumbaya, probably, after a serious harm and accountability process. So how will you know that, you know, you've succeeded? These, like, very tangible measures are how I tend to look at, quote-unquote, justice now. Like, what's actually happening at the end? And if what's happening at the end is, oh, well, some more people got hurt, you know, than at the beginning of the process, I'm not super inclined to look at that as a success.
So you used to be a therapist. What made you leave the therapy profession?
Partly, I'll just say I was burnt out. I was a very devoted therapist. Hopefully my clients would agree with me. I was very devoted, and I worked in the public sector. So, you know, I wasn't someone who had my own business and people paid me money to see me. I worked in an agency and people came to see me for free off a wait list. I started practicing therapy as a student when I was 21, which was probably too young. And the very first year, like, I remember I saw this pair of psychiatrists who were running a sexuality and gender clinic at a hospital in Montreal, and they said, oh, you're, they didn't really say this, but that vibe was like, oh, who's this kid? Oh, okay, well, you know, we'll help you out. So, you know, they gave me this practicum, and immediately I had 7 or 8 clients on a caseload who were deeply traumatized queer people, for the most part, not all of them, but many. And I mean, I have such respect for those people, working with this little young me with great forbearance. And then as I got older, I realized, like, it was very clear to me I had to learn a ton. So I, like, started, you know, listening to therapy podcasts and reading all these therapy books. And I really, you know, because people were counting on me. And then by the time I got my first professional job, I had been kind of slotted into, like, doing trans therapy work. And in Canada, I'm still, to this day, the only master's degree level clinician, even though I'm not practicing, still the only one who is a open trans woman today. What? In Canada. I've never met another, ever. So, you know, you can imagine, like, since I was working also for free, that I got a lot of referrals for people who were, you know, in some really tough circumstances. When one is working with wealthier people, you know, mental health work is like one thing. You're like working on thoughts and feelings and, you know, traumas. When one is working with people who don't have a ton of money, or in this case, like, lots of folks were in pretty difficult financial circumstances, it's a lot harder, like, because there's no really real way that you can heal a trauma, like, you know, feel safer when maybe your living situation is actually unsafe, right? So the burnout factor was high. And then the other piece is, like, I got really interested in, like, what happens outside of the therapy bubble, like, outside of this one-on-one interaction. We have all this knowledge about kind of healing individuals that's a bit useless if the individual doesn't have access to a better world. So, you know, the question is then, how do you make the better world for them? And I sort of, because of my own experiences and you know, interests landed on this, like, well, you know, I don't have a ton of power over like the social welfare system or anything, but I bet I could do some work around making our communities a bit better at dealing with conflict. We'll see how much success I have. I'm deeply interested in conflict. I'm studying conflict. I'm not yet very good at conflict. So we will see.
Yeah. There is this essay in your book where you talk about working with trans and gender nonconforming kids as a therapist. And something I was really thinking about when I was reading it was when you talk about how some kids, like disproportionately affluent white kids, have these parents that are giving them this open access to medical and legal transition because they're really invested in their kids, like assimilating and passing and, you know, being stealth if they want to. And then there are these other kids that are, of course, like disproportionately poor and non-white who don't have access to any of that, really access to any resources. That makes me wonder, like, what this new era in transness is going to look like. And I think you make that point in that book pretty well, that there's this new wave of trans kids, like, could be like really revolutionary, but also they, some of them have this ability that they could actually just assimilate more easily than like you and I could. I'm curious, like, what your thoughts are on, yeah, I didn't mean to say like the future of trans kids, but I guess that is kind of my question.
I have lots of thoughts on the future of trans kids. It's funny you should ask this because I think about this all the time and I don't get a ton of opportunities to talk about it these days, but yeah, I mean, you know, I have a day job and I still work in the kind of nonprofit sector in mental health, just not as a clinician. And my main function is supporting trans youths' families these days in a variety of different ways. And it's really fascinating to see that there is like a big sea change in trans class dynamics. I think really similar to something that happened around like gay and lesbian and bisexual cis people's class dynamics. Because it used to sort of be much more common. It still is common in a lot of places, but like it was sort of everyone's story that if you came out and were a gay man or a lesbian woman, then you would necessarily sort of become probably at least a little bit associated with working class folks, right? Mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. hustlers, like sex workers, this kind of thing. And obviously there were exceptions to that, but like because the gay and lesbian bisexual world had to be a hidden one, then that was a world where classes mixed much more and where like the downward class mobility was really kind of a main narrative. And that remained true for trans people. And it still is true for trans people. It's true for queer people, you know, again, all over the world. But there's this growing middle class of like mostly white gay and lesbians, right? And like cis people, that is. And what's really fascinating about trans folks is that that's kind of happening now, too. There's like this class of liberal parents, mostly white, but not all white, who, you know, have some ideas that are good ones about like supporting trans young people. And so when their kids come out, it's sort of like could be a little difficult, you know, some stress, sadness, fear mostly on the parts of parents. But then they sort of buck up and get their kid a photo shoot for the next Christmas card. And the wardrobe is replaced. And then there's appointments made at the hospital. And, you know, by and large, it's, you know, worked into the process of a middle class life. And simultaneously, there are still the kids who are being kicked out of their homes or who don't have access to medical care for reasons of like, you know, class or racialized barriers. What's really fascinating is you have this huge surge of transmasculine youth patients at gender clinics, right? And not as many trans feminine people and, you know, lots of questions about that. So, I mean, the future of trans kids, I mean, unfortunately, I do see that like a lot of younger trans people may not have, this is both fortunate and unfortunate, you know, they might have stronger relationships with their families, which is good, but maybe less perspective on like what it means, for example, to be a trans woman of color sex worker. Like those realities are becoming further and further apart. And while I'm happy for the people who don't have to suffer as much, I worry about what that means for our class solidarity in the trans community.
Yeah, I think that is a really good point. That's something I think about all the time because one of my main jobs is fundraising for trans people of color specifically. And I have a really hard time just like talking to straight cis white people a lot of the time because their idea of what constitutes wealth is so different. And that is something that I feel like comes out of transness is like, if you are trans, many of the people you know are like going to be like struggling so hard to find like housing and healthcare and employment that you, I feel at least like I am like so feel so acutely privileged just for having like very, very basic needs met. And I think that perspective is really important, you know, but also obviously my ideal solution to that is not more people suffer. My ideal solution to that is there is actually less suffering.
Yeah, exactly.
But as long as there is suffering, I want people to see it. So, yeah. Well, I want to make sure we get to talk about Fierce Femmes and Notorious Liars. The book is obviously very much focused around femmes as a concept, as a collective. And I try to ask every femme who comes on the show what femme means to them, because it always is like a really different answer. So what does femme mean to you? And what were you trying to express about femness like in this book?
Yeah, femme. I felt this wave of sadness as I thought about it, because it feels like what I was saying about femme when I wrote Fierce Femmes and Notorious Liars is already no longer a thing. And like the really, really rapid swirl of queer culture and new culture today, right? Like when I was transitioning for the second time, because I came out as a teenager and then I went back in, I was like forced back in by my family. And it was bizarre. Like I came out and then I went back in and I kind of forgot that I was trans. Like it's amazing what the mind does. Like I had a couple of years where I was like, yeah, I guess I'm just cis. And then suddenly I had a near-death experience and was like, nope, I'm trans. So I was in Montreal, Berlin, New York, perhaps some other places, San Francisco, like this sort of Anglo-Western queer culture was kind of having like the femme mask wars, right? Mm-hmm. 2012, and like people were like, I'm a femme. And it was popular for some reason at the time to say among lesbians that femmes had straight passing privilege and butches and
I remember this, yes.
Or you know, more oppressed. It was a serious argument at the time. And at the same time, you know, femmes were noticing like that femininity was being really devalued, both among kind of lesbian and trans AFAB communities. We were just starting to use AFAB then, I guess. And then among gay men and trans women, there was this kind of noticing that gay male culture was so obviously hypermasc in some ways, and that the femininity of those times was also really denigrated. So there was this hot, shining second where all these people of different feminine persuasions were coming together and being like, femme! We're into it. And I loved that moment. But there was always this question of like, well, are trans women femmes? Like, or should, you know, like, shouldn't trans women be a different category or whatever? And I loved being a femme. Like, I mean, this is going to sound really shallow, but I loved the heels and the makeup and the dress part of it. Not just because I wanted to be girly, although I really did that too, but I loved the power of that, right? Like the transgression, saying that femininity, for all of its stereotyping and problematicness, is also valuable, right? Like that the way toward a more feminist world was not to strip away these things like beauty, frivolity, gracefulness, like these things that are stereotypically associated with the feminine, but to celebrate, right? Like care and beauty and ornamentation, all this kind of stuff. And I really wanted trans women to have a part in that. And so when I wrote Fierce Femmes, I substituted the word trans or transgender or trans woman a lot of the time with the word femme, because that was sort of how we were using it at the time. And it also was an echo of the time when, well, I mean, still today, people do this, where, like, lesbian femmes would say things like, hey, femme, to each other, right? Like, there was this mutual recognition of the femme sisterhood. I still have that with some of my older femme friends. That's what femme is to me. It's deep history and beauty. And unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I don't know, I see that that politic has already kind of gone away, and there's whole new politics, and then there's good critiques of the femme politic, right? Like, what about the butch trans women, right? Like what about that? Mm-hmm. And there's just like all this stuff about femme and masks that don't quite work for everyone. So I like the critique, but I do have nostalgia for the days of you know, the high femmes, low femmes, glory femmes. I do miss that.
Yeah, it's so funny because this show is only 3 years old, a little more than 3 years old. And I realized when I was asking you that question, I almost didn't ask it because I felt like the landscape had changed so much since when I started asking people that question. But yeah, I still wanted to. I'm glad that I did.
Me too.
That was a great, great answer. Well, this book is fiction, but it's subtitled A Dangerous Trans Girl's Confabulous Memoir. Uh-huh. And you write at the very beginning, someone had to write Us Girls a Dangerous Story, a transgender memoir, but not like most of the 11,378 transgender memoirs out there. And like that really tapped into the frustration I have with a lot of trans memoir. Hashtag not all trans memoir. But, you know, I get a lot of galley copies as someone who does this job. And so many transgender memoirs just sound exactly the same. And they're so clearly written like for cis people. And so, yeah, can you just talk? I know you've done this before, but can you talk about like the tropes you are trying to avoid in this book?
Oh, for sure. I've done it before, but I never tire of it. Well, as you say, the memoir was the sort of original in the Western European canon, at least, but I imagine in other canons too, sort of the prototypical trans prose format, the tell-all, the memoir, the autobiography, the story of my shocking sex change. And it was almost always, right, like trans women writing that story. There's quite a few, you know, trans masculine versions of it too, but I think trans women sort of kicked off the genre. That line in Fierce Femmes that you quote is like sort of flippant. Speaking as Kai Cheng Tom, the author, I have a lot of tenderness around trans memoir too, because like it took and takes so much courage to write one for most people, and they paved the way. But also like the tropes are like, well, when I was young, I was always different, marked for difference, and like sort of like the Rudolph story, right? All the other mm-hmm. reindeer laughed and called me names. And then I found a doctor, and there was something that happened with my family, and it was either tragic, or I thought it would be tragic, but there was a plot twist and they supported me. Then I had a difficult romance and someone broke up with me because I was trans. And then very unfortunately, there's like a trope, I think it was just kind of true to life, that, you know, trans people getting sexually harmed, right, in their forays into romance, and this desperate pursuit of surgery, and, you know, always wanting what I see in the mirror to match what I feel on the inside, right? And
yeah, I watched Mulan recently. I've seen that.
I love that song. Don't get me wrong. I've done burlesque to that song. Uh-huh. You know, it is a trope, and it feels trapped. And I'll tell you something interesting. I'm not sure I've mentioned this on any interview before. I really wanted to write a trans memoir. I just wanted to write one that was really interesting that people liked. And the fashion was really changing. Right at that time that Fierce Femmes was being written, there was a wave of new trans literature, also mostly trans women, but not entirely, like starting with Nevada from Topside Press, and it was a lot of white trans women too. Not to knock that, but just to say that's what it was. And like there was this strong, strong push, like no to the memoir, no to self-disclosure, no to like the lone trans person character, right? Like we want multiple trans people characters, lots of inter-trans dialogue. And I was kind of like, that's awesome, but I also want a book that's like, you know, a roadmap, TS roadmap, right? Like how do I become trans? And so that's kind of what I was like thinking about this. I was like, you know, why is the memoir not satisfying, but why am I also not satisfied by, you know, not that I dislike Nevada, I love Nevada, but like, why do I feel like I have something to add to this conversation that's not there yet? And like Fierce Femmes is a roadmap. Like it is meant to be like a how-to in certain ways, not in others, obviously, but it's meant to, it's not a how-to how to do murder. No friends, but it is a how-to about survival. Cause I wasn't looking for a how-to about like, how do I get hormones and survive a sexual assault? I was looking for a how-to about how do I be brave and fierce and find sisterhood and like that kind of thing. And that's kind of how Fierce Femmes and its sort of anti-memoir got born.
Yeah, and definitely not to knock trans memoir, and particularly the trans memoir that did get us here, you know, like the trans memoir of years past. I think all of my frustration is misguided, to be clear, because there are so many books by cis people. Why am I not frustrated? But I think my frustration with like recent trans memoir is my feeling that comes up with a lot of like transmedia oriented towards cis people, which is just like, we have seen this already and like this already exists.
Oh, absolutely.
And like, what is a new thing that we can contribute? Which is why I appreciate you being like, here's a new thing I can contribute, because yeah, your book is well known for a reason, because it is really doing something that we don't see often.
Thank you. Can I say something daring that you might sort of be heading toward, but I'm just going to push myself into deep possible hot water. I hear you, because I respect trans memoir and I love trans memoir, and ooh, this is the daring thing, here it comes. I think that in the recent years, like maybe past 5-10 years, there's been trans memoir that's come out that feels very commercial.
Yes.
Like super commercial. And I'm not going to say any names, but like, I'm sure we can think of some highly, highly commercialized trans autobiographies or like life narratives that's very aimed at cis people. It's sort of the like inspirational brand. And I'm like, I actually don't like those memoirs. And you know what? Like, you said that thing about like, well, why aren't we frustrated with cis books? And that's true, but I am frustrated with cis books all the time. I'm like, I don't know. I'm like, if one is like a super famous, very wealthy trans person, like on, you know, mainstream TV, then of all people, probably they could afford to be daring, right? And I would contrast that with like memoir, like, you know, Janet Mock does a classic trans memoir, but her memoir is very daring, even though it is classic. And like, so I see commercialized trans narratives out there and I don't like them. Just going to be real.
I think that is the word that I was looking for that really does define it, is commercialized trans memoir.
That's the thing. And I actually tried to write a short story about this once, never finished it, but like about like a dystopia where like, you know how there like sprang up a gay wedding industry after gay weddings were legalized in the States? Well, I could really easily imagine like a transition industry all about like the party and like the renaming and the new clothes, you know? You could get a transition coach who would coach your 16-year-old to, and like, I just, like the intense privilege that would come up around certain trans kids, and then the intense ignoring that would come up around trans kids of color, trans people in prison, older trans people, right? Like, just like there being like a respectable, liberal way to be trans, and that was like in opposition to everything that trans liberation movements have stood for over the past 50, 60 years. I could really easily envision that happening, you know, in the next decade, and I don't want it. I reject it. I am saying no.
You mention quite a few times in I Hope We Choose Love that you're, you know, queer famous, or another word you use is micro celebrity. A lot of the things you wrote about with your experience with that, like, really spoke to me. You said, for all its edgy pretensions, social justice culture had not prepared me for the havoc that abuse, mental illness, and the immense pressure of living as a publicly known trans woman of color in the social media era could wreak upon my soul. Do you think there is anything that could have prepared you for that?
Oh, great question. Could anything have prepared me for that? I don't know. I think I'm leaning towards like probably not. However, I do wish, like an impossible kind of wish, that I guess that I had had real elders, but not even necessarily like elder elders. I mean, like, could I have had real mentors or good parents, to be honest. I love my parents, but they didn't know how to parent me. Like, I was a young person who was thrashing, right? Like, just absolutely like hurling myself onto the social media platforms in a desperate bid to be seen. And I see that in so many trans young people, and also now I guess lots of millennials who are not so young. You know, to be a former therapist and also to have worked with many trans youth, you know, I worked with many trans micro celebrities. And I saw that they were struggling with the same things I was struggling with. And like, I wish that instead of having to go to social media for that validation, which is like, it's like people kind of knock validation and attention seeking, but let's be real, people, like especially young people, but all people, we need attention. We need validation. It's actually a central part of mental health, is to be affirmed and validated. And because so many of us just didn't get it from our schools or from our parents, went to social media and got stuck in a loop of being like, the attention on social media is love, but it isn't. It's conditional, it's dangerous, it's very traumatic. And what it actually is a codependent relationship in most cases. Like, We're so reliant on this sort of merging of minds that happens on social media. And then the minute something wrong happens, it explodes and blows up. And then, you know, we delete our account and then we come back on the next week. Yeah, I wish that someone had kind of told me that not just told me, but someone could have been there for me. And you know, I talked to a lot of, I used to have clients who were trans young people. I still have a lot of, you know, friends who are younger than me. I try to be really conscious of like that the 6-year difference sometimes or the 4-year difference can be big because unfortunately you just have to grow up so fast as a trans person. I try to say things like that people matter even outside of their social media presence or outside of their performance life or their art life or whatever, right? Like these things that we think are so important in the trans queer world, like, you know, art is weirdly important to us. Like art is amazing, but it's not everything, right? It's not everything to be a famous model or actress or writer or, you know, cartoonist. That we're valuable, like outside of that and outside of our political expression too is super key. And it's funny because I say these things, I see them sort of go in and also not, right? Like people are like, yeah, sure, like, whatever. I'm going to continue being an influencer. I'm like, that's good too, right? Like, that's also fine. I just, you know, would hope that we can grow healthier relationships to that. And I'm trying to go for that myself. I don't always know if I'm succeeding, but I sure know that it's so, so important to have friends that don't only care about you because you're a micro celeb.
Something else that really resonated with me is you writing about how, you know, being like a known person in this world, in the SJW world, is like to be pushed to be perfect all the time for all people. And the consequence of failure is punishment. I'm just reading now. I guess I'm just wondering like how you've gotten to a space or if you've gotten to a space that you felt comfortable like existing in a community that's like so quick to tear people down at sort of the slightest infraction.
Love this. Well, as I have wandered the world, I have learned that it is not just us. It's not just the queers. It's also small religious communities, small migrant communities, different values often, or like different rules. But the tearing down is sort of like this universal almost thing. And it's quite new. I suspect that we have this sort of huge mainstream society where anonymity used to be the norm. Obviously, it's not now, but, you know, until about the thousands, anonymity was the norm-ish. And there was this idea that, like, you were separate from your work or your, you know, whatever. And, you know, the mainstream got everything wrong. But I do kind of like that idea, like, that we could be kind of separate occasionally. I don't know if that's a sustainable idea. But anyway, yeah, how do I become comfortable? I guess I resign myself to, like, interdependence, hopefully not codependence, but there's some of that. Like I did a lot of thinking about how does a small community work? Because lots have worked for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years. And how does it work to be an individual in a small community? And, you know, that's an ongoing exploration. What I've sort of landed on is like, I need to know what the values of the collective are. I need to be empathetic to the values of the collective. And I need to have my own values. Like I need to do my own individuation work, like really explore myself to know what it is I believe. And that's, I think, like, this is also kind of where I get into my like yoga, meditation, wellness, world, love. And you know, that's one way to go about it. But you can go about individuation in any number of ways. And what I really think is important and is not an indulgence, right? Is not liberalism, is taking the responsibility for your knowing yourself and knowing what you stand for is key. It is a key part of being an adult in a highly networked community, because it is so easy if we don't know ourselves, and even if we do, it's still pretty easy, to relinquish responsibility for our ethical actions when we get lost in the roar of the mob. And so, you know, when the collective says, you know, your friend is problematic, so let's kick him out. Or, I mean, in my case, I've seen that person is problematic, so let's beat him up. Like physically, it was a real thing. It's very easy, right? In the fear, in the righteousness, in the not wanting to be wrong, to be like, yeah, I'll beat up my friend, right? Or like, yeah, I'll not talk to that person anymore. Like whatever, whatever, right? And I've done that. I've made that decision not to beat anyone up, but I've made the decision to like drop people or, you know, bash people online and stuff. Like I've done that, you know, it's happened. And stepped out of my integrity. And that is not ethical. Like, that's not right. So it's not that I've become comfortable taking a contrarian position, because I'm actually very uncomfortable with it all the time. But I've become more uncomfortable with nodding along or like letting things go just because everyone else seems to be saying that that's the way it has to be. And that's because I have unfortunately really seen some bad shit happen, like on my watch when I didn't stand up for my values. And so like, this is like real me sparing my soul now, but I really mean like horrible, horrible, horrible things, like life-changing harm. Like I've witnessed happen in community that I didn't always stand up to or didn't stand up to in time. And that has made me, you know, deeply depressed and even suicidal at some points. And so my survival, like the survival of my soul, the survival of my body, and in some ways, I think the survival of others who count on me, that is predicated on being honest. And I don't always do that well. I don't even always do an okay job of that, but it is what I am dedicated to in this life.
Yeah, that reminds me of one more thing that I want to make sure that we talk about, because I think it's really important that people hear it. And I think you speak to it really well. As trans people, we talk a lot about how like the gender binary is false and harmful and biological sex binary is false and harmful. But you point out something I really like in your book, which is that there are other binaries that are harmful. And that includes like oppressor versus oppressed and survivor versus abuser and like problematic versus pure. Can you talk a bit about the harm that happens when we split people into this sort of like problematic, unproblematic binary or the like abuser, abused binary?
Oh, yes. This could be a book on its own. Yeah. I mean, the harm, like it could be a book because it's vast, like the harm of the binary, right? And it's sort of just the same harm about the binaries that you mentioned that we're so good at naming, right? Like we're good at naming that the gender binary is harmful and the biological sex binary is harmful. Why? Because it erases people, it dehumanizes them. And at its extreme, which we have seen many times in history, that the binary also then gives way to like excuses for heinous actions on the part of the medical complex or the police complex or the justice, the supposed justice complex. And binaries have been used like that for, you know, many, many, many years to various extremes. And they can't all be compared because they're not all comparable. But like, you know, when we start to sort people into binaries, we start to dehumanize because we lose individual context. And, you know, it's a very kind of slidey scale there when we attach moral worth to a certain part of a binary, like, oh, maybe males are better than females, or, you know, maybe straight people are better than queer people. That moral attachment really quickly becomes, and then all those other people who are not as valuable maybe should just disappear or should just shut up or just become subservient or just, you know, like all these kinds of things. So I want to talk about this carefully because it requires care. The binary of good and evil, or like pure and problematic, those binaries, they do that same thing. I get why we need them or why we want them, right? Like, you know, I was just talking about values integrity, like standing in your values. And it's so hard to stand in our values in this confusing, horrible, violent world, traumatic world. You know, and there's neurological reasons for this too, right? Like our brain becomes attenuated to like black and white thinking, this quick sorting, right? Like who's a friend, who's a foe, and becomes very tempting and, you know, in some cases very strategic to say, I'm just going to write this category of people off, right? Anyone who's problematic, they're never going to harm me again, right? Like that's sort of where that comes from. They're never going to hurt me again. And I'm super sympathetic to that. But we lose the context. And we start to lose our discernment. And that discernment is like, if we're always saying that we're going to get rid of all the problematic people, what's going to happen when we are problematic? Well, we'd have to be gotten rid of. So then we develop, you know, a complex around, well, I can never be problematic. And this is where all kinds of weird, bizarre, painful stuff can happen, our collective delusion that anyone could ever be pure, like politically pure, or not harmful. Like being a human is to harm others. So we harmed something today by eating a hamburger, right? Like it is just like that is part of our existence, is that we hurt others. That's not a good thing, but we have to admit it. And it's so difficult to do that work of integrating that reality that we lash out at others. And then, you know, there's lots of writing about this. I'm probably going to get canceled just for saying this, but, you know, Sarah Schulman writes about this mentality in Conflict Is Not Abuse when she's focusing on the Israel-Palestine kind of conflict / you know, occupation. The idea that having suffered horrible, horrible ancestral trauma and, you know, social violence and genocide could justify a colonization of another indigenous peoples, right? Like, that's sort of where this binary starts to take us. And yeah, I'm not there for it. And then the last binary you mentioned is the survivor-perpetrator dynamic. And that's the one that requires the most care, right? At least I think it does, because it's so sensitive. And I want to be clear. There's a lot of really shitty ways that my work and Sarah Schulman's work and, I don't know, Porpentine Charity Heartscape's work, like anyone who's writing about like nuance and conflict and transformative justice, even Adrian Marie Brown, like whatever, there's any kind of ways that this work could be used to delegitimize a survivor's truth. And I hate that. Like, I'm not there for it. There's so many ways that, you know, any rhetoric can be used to deflect like real accountability or honesty. And that's disgusting. I hate it. But it's also a truth, right? Like we can hold more than one truth at the same time, that being human is to harm. And as Miriam Kaba says, no one is introduced to violence as a perpetrator. No one is introduced to violence as a perpetrator. So when we start to ask ourselves the question, how do we end violence? Actually, I just don't believe that it is a functional answer to say we're going to get rid of the violent people. You know, like, there'll just be this endless cycle kind of trying to get rid. We have to start talking about, why do we do violence? And what does it look like when we do violence? How can we tell the truth about that? And that is so much messier than there's a group of predatory people who are all evil, and they're just hiding among us. Like waiting for the opportunity. The truth is that that harmful being is usually someone lashing out in their own attempt to survive, often misguided attempt to survive. And the only way we are going to not have that problem in such a present way is to ask, what is it that we need to survive? And then make sure everybody gets that.
This is the part of the show where I ask you if there's anything else that you want to talk about that I haven't asked you about yet.
Oh, yes. I'll just have one thing. Thank you.
You have as many things as you want.
Okay, well then two. One really cool thing I heard about trauma from a clinician way back when I was still doing continuing ed for social work was that one form of trauma is the painful embodied memory that has no words. This thing we feel that we don't know how to speak to out loud, because literally the words aren't there. And that gets me thinking about like what happens when we're denied language, right? Like, let's just take, you know, queers and trans people, like sexualities and genders that are non-normative. So many of us just don't even have any words for that, particularly those of us who grew up, you know, like a little bit before the current generation. So like, that's a trauma. And like, when we think about like, okay, so what about the stuff that many of us are thinking and feeling about, you know, social justice community and the ways we hurt each other, but there's no words because it's scary to say, or we haven't even been told there's a way to say it. I think that's a trauma. I think we need to like see this work of unveiling the binaries we create and building transformative justice as healing work. And it's slow and scary, but it's healing us. Anyway, that's my thing one. Thing two is, you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, I've done a lot of goop white lady podcasts. And it's so true. I have done so.
Oh, yeah. That was before we were recording. So
yes,
I did say that.
And I'm trying to come out these days as a wellness person because it's such a separate part of my life. Like, I've got my like hardcore queer anarchist friends, and then I'm like, I also sometimes go to places where people end every sentence with prayer hands. Like, okay, I just wanted to kind of touch on wellness and meditation because it's something that's so important to me, like my spirituality and my like somatics practice and stuff. I think there's something really rich and beautiful in spiritual healing and personal healing that has been denied to queers, and particularly queer people of color, but also all queers, right? Because we are sort of disembodied to begin with. Like, every queer person has at some level been told that their embodied experience is wrong. You're not supposed to have that sexual feeling for that person, or you're not supposed to have this engendered feeling about yourself. And so I'm kind of on a mission to reclaim embodiment for myself. And I want all the queers to be there with me. I'm like, oh my God, let's get into our bodies and love our bodies, which is not in the way of like, I like my body, because it's just not possible to like your body all the time. And for some people, it's really hard to like it ever. But to like really know that the body is important and that it has its own secret wisdom. I think the answers to so many...
Time.
C is for...
cauliflower.
Confusion.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio, Feminist Waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy.
The Dragon Root Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragon Root understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance.
We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio. On today's show, we're speaking with the editor of Kohol magazine about their recent issue on queer feminisms. We also will feature a clip with the hosts of Yoga is Dead, which focuses on racism and other issues in the wellness industry. But first up, we are speaking with Kuperg McGill on their upcoming Culture Shock event series.
Can you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about Kuperg?
Hi, my name is Sasha Simmons. I'm the Working Groups and Community Research Coordinator at Kuperg McGill. So I'll describe Kuperg first. Kuperg McGill is a nonprofit organization on McGill campus that basically runs as a resource center, trying to connect students together with the larger community in Montreal around issues related to like activism and social justice. So we do that in a pretty large variety of different ways through hosting events, offering work study and summer jobs that students can